Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents The Blessing and the Curse, The Jewish People and Their Books in the 20th Century, by Adam Kirsch, narrated by Stephen J. Cohen. Introduction. Near the end of the book of Deuteronomy, Moses charges the Israelites to keep the laws that God has given them, setting out two possible futures for the Jewish people. If they follow God's laws, they will be blessed with prosperity and power in their promised land. And the Lord will make thee overabundant for good, in the fruit of thy body, and in the fruit of thy cattle, and in the fruit of thy land, in the land which the Lord swore unto thy fathers to give thee. But if they forsake God, they will be cursed with pestilence and famine, defeated in war, and left powerless before their enemies. The Lord will bring a nation against thee from far, from the end of the earth, as the vulture swoopeth down, a nation whose tongue thou shalt not understand, a nation of fierce countenance that shall not regard the person of the old, nor show favor to the young. Moses promises the Israelites that their fate lies in their own hands, that God will deal with them as they deserve. I have set before thee life and death, the blessing and the curse. Therefore choose life, that thou mayest live. Strangely, however, Moses' words also suggest that both parts of the prophecy, the blessing and the curse, are destined to come true. And it shall come to pass, when all these things are come upon thee, the blessing and the curse, which I have set before thee. It is as if he could foresee that over the next 3,000 years, the Jewish people would experience both blessing and curse, not just once, but over and over again, with eras of glory and security giving way to eras of dispossession and terror. But in no epoch did the Jews experience the blessing and the curse in more extreme forms than in the 20th century. In the span of a single lifetime, things that Jews had long thought impossible because they were too precious to dream about or too horrifying to imagine came to pass. In the year 1900, some 7 million Jews lived in Eastern and Central Europe, about 2/3 of the world's Jewish population. The primacy of this Ashkenazi heartland had, in fact, already begun to erode. Starting in the 1880s, a vast emigration, ultimately numbering 2 million people, had begun to carry Jews out of Eastern Europe to a new life in the United States. Around the same time, a much smaller group of Jews, numbering in the tens of thousands, began to settle in Palestine under the inspiration of Zionist ideals. These movements created the nucleus of the two communities that now make up most of the world Jewry. Today, America and Israel are each home to about 5.5 million Jews. These emigrations also turned out to be lifeboats sent out at the last moment. For between 1939 and 1945, Eastern European Jewry was largely annihilated in the Holocaust, which killed 6 million Jews. As a result, the world's Jewish population is barely higher today than it was in 1900, even as the world's total population grew sevenfold. Each of these three histories, the fate of the Jews in Europe, America, and Israel, was, in its own way, unprecedented. The Holocaust did not completely eradicate Jewish life in Europe. Today, there are some 1.5 million Jews on the continent, now mostly in the West, rather than the East. But it did destroy a Jewish civilization that had endured, despite persecutions and expulsions, for 1,000 years. In the decades before the Holocaust, many European Jews had tried to join Gentile civilization. Many others had remained committed to traditional ways. And, An intrepid few had tried to unite both worlds, but the Nazis were indiscriminate, killing every Jew they could find, and thereby falsifying every answer to the question of how the Jews could live in Europe. The extremity of the evil called into question the central assumption of both traditional Judaism and Western civilization, and perhaps neither has fully recovered since. Ironically, at the very same time that Europe was proving itself unimaginably hostile, America was proving itself unprecedentedly welcoming. In the United States, particularly after World War II, Jews found a more open and liberal environment than perhaps anywhere they had lived in the diaspora. Previous Jewish golden ages, Islamic Spain, Enlightenment Germany, had offered limited cultural and political opportunities to an elite at best. America offered security and openness to almost everyone. Indeed, for much of the 20th century, the chief worry of American Judaism was that it might disappear in the warm embrace of assimilation and intermarriage, rather than in gas chambers, as was happening in Europe. Meanwhile, Jews in Israel were fulfilling a dream even older than the dream of safety. In the year 70, after a Jewish revolt against Roman power, a Roman army destroyed the temple in Jerusalem. In 135, after a second revolt, the Romans exiled the Jews from Judea and erased it from the map, renaming the province Syria Palestina, the origin of the modern name Palestine. For the next 1800 years, no matter where they lived, Jews considered themselves to be in galut, exile. The idea that they would one day return to the land of Israel was central to Judaism, if not to the actual daily lives of most Jews, but that return was conceived of in miraculous terms, as a deliverance that would come in the Messianic Age. But in 1948, after half a century of effort by Zionists and against violent opposition, the State of Israel was born, and Jewish sovereignty was restored in the very place where it had disappeared 2 millennia earlier. Perhaps the best way to think of these 20th century destinies is as the liquidation of the Jewish concept of exile. In Europe, it was terminated by the death of 6 million Jews, which seemed to show that exile was no longer a possible way of life, but only an avenue to death. In America, exile came to seem like a false description of Jewish life, as Jews began to see themselves as part of the new narrative of American immigration, rather than the ancient story of Jewish wandering. And in Israel, exile was directly refuted by Zionism, whose goal was the creation of a country where Jews could finally be at home, rather than unwanted guests. After all these transformations, and the enormous universal transformation wrought by modern secularism and rationalism, how could Jews in the 20th century continue to believe the same things in the same way that their ancestors did? But if they didn't, if most modern Jews no longer believed in Jewish doctrines or obeyed Jewish laws, then what did it mean to call themselves Jews? In one way, at least, Jews met these revolutionary times with a traditional response. They wrote books. Judaism is a religion founded on texts, the Bible and the Talmud, and textual study has always been the hallmark of Jewish education. In Rabbinic Judaism, mastery of textual interpretation was the highest religious as well as intellectual achievement. Over the centuries of exile, while Jews were largely unable to create physical monuments or exert political power, they channeled their creative energy into the production of books. But in literary terms, too, the 20th century marked a departure. In post-biblical Jewish writing, the most prestigious texts were not what we would now call imaginative literature. They were rather books of legal analysis, philosophy, mystical speculation, biblical interpretation, liturgical poetry, or moral instruction. Jewish literature was literature about Judaism in all its aspects. Not until the 19th century did this begin to change, as Jews made contact with secular European culture and began to produce autonomously literary writing. And not until the 20th century does it become possible to gain an unprecedentedly rich and intimate understanding of Jewish experience by reading novels, poems, plays, and memoirs by Jewish writers, in Yiddish and Hebrew, as well as in English, Russian, German, and the other languages Jews began to speak in large numbers. The Blessing and the Curse is divided into four sections, one for each of these themes in 20th century Jewish history: Europe, America, Israel, and the attempt to formulate Judaism as a modern faith. Each section offers a chronological survey of major books drawing mainly on fiction and memoir in the first three sections, and on theology and philosophy in the fourth. The purpose of this arrangement is twofold: to introduce listeners to some of the most significant and compelling Jewish books of the 20th century, and to use these books to explore central aspects of Jewish experience. In Europe, literature documents how it felt for Jews to see their future disappear, as the dark intuitions of the first decades of the century, given fictional forms by writers like Franz Kafka, Isaac Babel, and Isaac Bashevis Singer, gave way to the even darker actualities witnessed by Victor Klemperer, Anne Frank, and Primo Levi. In America, literature shows how the New World made it possible for Jews to shed most of what had long defined Jewishness, only to leave them wondering what, if anything, made Jewish identity still meaningful. This quandary, which appears already in the earliest American Jewish fiction by writers like Abraham Kahan and Anzia Yezerska, would take on moral, metaphysical, and political dimensions in the work of Saul Bellow, Philip Roth, Bernard Malamud, and Cynthia Ozick. In Israel, literature occupied a particularly challenging role, as it carved out a space for individual imagination and experience in a place defined by collective effort and historical myth. Even before the State of Israel was created, this tension between Zionist dream and Israeli reality was a great theme for S.Y. Agnon, who first came to Palestine in the 1900s, just as it would be for writers like Amos Oz, David Grossman, and Yehuda Amichai. Finally, the last section, Making Judaism Modern, examines the work of religious thinkers who tried to reconcile tradition with 20th century needs and realities, offering different strategies for synthesis and renewal. From the cultural Zionism of Martin Buber to the existential engagement of Abraham Joshua Heschel, to the feminist reinventions of Judith Plaskow. As this outline shows, the scope of the book is limited in important ways. It focuses primarily on Ashkenazi experience, that is, on Jews from Central and Eastern Europe and their descendants, at the expense of Sephardic and Mizrahi experience. It focuses on secular and modern genres, which means that it takes little account of the writing that continued to be produced in traditional religious genres, and it discusses only books that are available in English translation. Clearly, this means The Blessing and the Curse cannot be a comprehensive history of 20th century Jewish writing, nor a canon of the best books by Jewish writers, though I believe most of the books discussed here would find a place in such a canon. Rather, my hope in writing this book is more modest: to use literature to illuminate the extreme contrasts of modern Jewish experience while introducing the listener to some of the richness of 20th century Jewish writing. 1. Europe. The Future Disappears. The Road into the Open by Arthur Schnitzler. The Trial by Franz Kafka. Red Cavalry by Isaac Babel. Satan in Gorée by Isaac Bashevis Singer, The Diary of Victor Klemperer, The Diary of Anne Frank, Night by Elie Wiesel, Survival in Auschwitz by Primo Levi, Eichmann in Jerusalem by Hannah Arendt. The Road into the Open by Arthur Schnitzler and The Trial by Franz Kafka. Vienna in the years before World War I was one of the golden ages of Jewish history. Over the preceding half century, Jews from Austria's Polish and Ukrainian territories, freed from old residential restrictions, flocked to the capital's economic opportunities. In the 1850s, there were only 2,500 Jews in Vienna. By 1900, there were 150,000, almost 10% of the city's population. And while most of them were poor or working class, the Jewish bourgeoisie was prosperous and open-minded enough to serve as the main patrons of the city's cultural and intellectual life. According to the writer Stefan Zweig, looking back on this period in his memoir, The World of Yesterday, the part played by the Jewish bourgeoisie in Viennese culture through the aid and patronage it offered was immeasurable. They were the real public. They filled seats at the theater and in concert halls. They bought books and pictures, visited exhibitions, championed and encouraged new trends everywhere, with minds that were more flexible, less weighed down by tradition. Jewish artists and thinkers, too, were central to the city's ferment. An inhabitant of Vienna in these years could have made an appointment with Sigmund Freud for psychoanalysis in the afternoon, heard Gustav Mahler conduct one of his new symphonies in the evening, and then stayed up late at a cafe, listening to the arguments of writers like Zweig and Karl Kraus. Among their subjects would likely have been Zionism, the movement founded by the Viennese journalist Theodor Herzl in 1897. Yet all of this activity did not endear the Jews of Vienna to their Gentile neighbors. On the contrary, as the Jewish population of the city grew, so did popular anti-Semitism. From 1897 to 1910, the mayor of Vienna was Karl Luger, an anti-Semitic politician who rallied against the presence and influence of the Jews. Many Jews didn't take Luger's hatred very seriously, but many of his Gentile listeners did, including Adolf Hitler, who contracted his own case of virulent anti-Semitism while living in Vienna before World War I. The city that was a showcase of Jewish life also served as a testing ground for the Jew hatred that was to culminate in the Holocaust. During these years, Arthur Schnitzler was one of Vienna's most prominent Jewish writers. Trained as a doctor, he gave up medicine to pursue a career in literature, a choice that made perfect sense in a city that made a religion of the arts. Schnitzler became famous thanks to his 1903 play, Reigen, better known by its French title, La Ronde, an unsparing look at the city's erotic life, framed as a series of sexual encounters between partners from every social class, from prostitutes to noblemen. The play was too risque to be performed publicly, but it became a bestseller and the source of much moralistic criticism, often framed in anti-Semitic terms. In 1908, Schnitzler continued his investigation into Viennese sexual malaise with the novel The Road into the Open. At the center of the novel is a Gentile character, indeed an aristocrat, Georg von Wertentin, who embarks on an affair with a young Catholic girl named Anna Rosner. Georg is a study in indecision, refusing to make serious commitments either to his musical career, which he engages in only amateurishly, or to Anna, whom he gets pregnant but refuses to marry. But what gives The Road into the Open its enduring interest is not Schnitzler's portrait of the sexual mores and spiritual drift of Viennese intellectuals. It is, rather, the novel's sympathetic portraits of Georg's Jewish friends, who are trying in various ways to come to terms with their anomalous place in an increasingly anti-Semitic society. For an aristocrat like Gerg to have so many Jewish friends is a sign that, on an elite level at least, the barriers to social intercourse were declining. In these circles, a baron like Gerg can socialize on equal terms with Jews like Elsa Ehrenberg, a music aficionado who cherishes a silent, unrequited love for him, or Heinrich Berman, a writer who proposes to collaborate with him on an opera. For most of the Jewish characters in The Road into the Open, Jewishness is no longer a religious identity or even a cultural one. In all visible respects, they share the same values and lead the same lifestyle as their Gentile neighbors. Yet this only makes the anti-Semitism they face harder to deal with, since no conceivable adaptation on their part can diffuse it. The result is that relationships between Jews and Gentiles, even when they approach intimacy, are never without self-consciousness. They may be able to dissimulate some of the time, Schnitzler suggests, but at the bottom, every Jew mistrusts every Christian, and every Christian has contempt for every Jew. As Heinrich Berman demands of Gerg, "Do you think there's a single Christian in the world, even taking the noblest, straightest, and truest one you like, one single Christian, who has not in some moment or other of spite, temper, or rage made at any rate mentally some contemptuous allusion to the Jewishness of even his best friend, his mistress, or his wife, if they were Jews or of Jewish descent?" To Gerg, on the other hand, it seems that Jews are simply too quick to take offense, too obsessed with their own Jewishness. Why do they always begin to talk about it themselves? Wherever he went, he only met Jews who were ashamed of being Jews, or the type who were proud of it and were frightened of people thinking they were ashamed of it, Gerg reflects. He can't understand why Jews lack the instinctive ease and self-confidence he enjoys as a titled aristocrat. As we might say today, he is blinded by his own privilege. Indeed, the very terms of his complaint show that Jews are in an impossible situation. Neither shame nor pride is the right reaction to their condition. But what is the alternative? Through Gerg's eyes, we witness the agonizing attempts of Vienna's young Jews to make sense of their place in a country that both is and is not their home. One of his acquaintances, the musician Leo Golowski, attends a Zionist Congress and is impressed by the serious purpose of the Jews who have embraced Zionism. With these people, whom he saw at close quarters for the first time, the yearning for Palestine, he knew it for a fact, was no artificial pose. The genuine feeling was at work within them, a feeling that had never become extinguished and was now flaming up afresh under the stress of necessity. Leo, who is persecuted by an anti-Semitic army officer, ends up challenging the man to a duel and killing him, evidence perhaps of the self-respect that Zionism tried to imbue in Europe's Jews. Leo's sister, Teresa, on the other hand, opts for the other great political movement of the age, socialism. She becomes a social democratic deputy to parliament and spends time in jail for insulting the emperor. But no one in the novel takes her quite seriously, partly because she is an elegant young woman, partly because the idea of a future socialist revolution seemed incredible, at least in 1908. Meanwhile, Dr. Stauber, another young Jewish politician, has to resign his seat in the face of the unrelenting anti-Semitic abuse that is showered on him every time he gets up to speak in parliament. Party politics, Schnitzler suggests, is no cure for the Jewish problem. Then, there is Oskar Ehrenberg, who believes he can force his way into Austrian society by aping the aristocracy and pretending not to be Jewish at all. This strategy ends in disaster when he demonstratively takes off his hat in front of the door of a church, a gesture of respect that is meant to help him pass as a Catholic, only to be seen by his father, who is infuriated at this Jewish betrayal, and publicly boxes Oscar on the ears. The episode becomes the talk of the town. Oscar is disgraced, and he even tries to commit suicide, but he fails to aim properly and ends up losing an eye. His friends debate whether his fate is tragic or, as Teresa says, enough to make one laugh till one cried. For Jews in an anti-Semitic society, even suffering lacks dignity since it is so bound up with feelings of shame and self-loathing. In the end, it is left to Heinrich, Gerg's closest Jewish friend, to express the true hopelessness of the situation. Heinrich rejects Zionism because he rejects any form of group identity. He felt himself akin with no one, no, not with anyone in the whole world. For Judaism, as for all religions, he has only contempt. What does the faith of your father mean to you? A collection of customs which you have now ceased to observe, and some of which seem as ridiculous and in as bad taste to you as they do to me, he tells Leo. Yet, while he rejects positive forms of solidarity, Heinrich identifies completely with the Jews when it comes to feeling shame and embarrassment. We have been egged on from our youth to look upon Jewish peculiarities as particularly grotesque or repulsive, he explains to Gerg. I will not disguise it. If a Jew shows bad form in my presence or behaves in a ridiculous manner, I have often so painful a sensation that I should like to sink into the earth. But this revulsion does not delude Heinrich into thinking that he could ever become a true Austrian either. In Austria, he says to Gerg's shock, Jews are in a foreign country, or in an enemy's country. That is precisely why Jews are such good students of Austrian culture and society. After all, the primary essential is to get to know one's enemies as well as possible, both their good qualities and their bad. Finally, Heinrich throws up his hands and declares that the problems of antisemitism and Jewish self-hatred will take at least 1,000 years to solve. In our time, there won't be any solution. That's absolutely positive. No universal solution, at any rate. It will rather be a case of a million different solutions, for it's just a question which, for the time being, everyone has got to settle for himself as best he can. Everyone must manage to find an escape for himself out of his vexation, or out of his despair, or out of his loathing, to some place or other where he can breathe again, in freedom. Everyone's life simply depends on whether or not he finds his mental way out. As it turned out, the Jews of Vienna didn't have 1,000 years to wait. They had exactly 30. In 1938, Nazi Germany would annex Austria amid a fierce outburst of popular antisemitism. Over the next year, about 2/3 of the city's Jewish population of 200,000 fled. The mental way out that Heinrich looked for was not nearly enough. Of the Jews who remained in the city, all but 2,000 were exterminated in the Holocaust. By 1945, the Jewish population of Vienna had returned to the level of the 1850s. Jewish Vienna, it turned out, had lasted a little less than a century. The art and literature created in that brief span have made it an object of fascination and nostalgia ever since. But the road into the open is melancholy proof that even at their peak of wealth and achievement, the Jews of Central Europe sensed they were living a life without a future. The hopelessness that Schnitzler diagnosed in The Road into the Open was not confined to Jews alone. Gerg von Wurdentin himself suffers from a disease of the will that makes it impossible for him to commit to any course of action. Whether it is his dream of becoming a great composer, or his guilty sense that he is morally obligated to marry the mother of his child, for him, too, it seems impossible to chart a path to the future. He is a perpetual youth. Frivolous and a little unconscientious, as Heinrich describes him, who is never quite ready to take up the responsibilities of adulthood. Gerg, however, doesn't suffer from his condition the way the novel's Jewish characters do. If he is living a dream, at least it is a pleasant dream, full of music and romance. It's not hard to see in this character Schnitzler's fond yet critical portrait of the Austro-Hungarian Empire.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?